Hey there, welcome to the very last lecture in Research Methods and Statistics 2. I can't believe you're even bothering to listen to this, you nerd. The goal of this recording is mainly to talk about how you might decide which statistical test you should run given the description of some study. So if you're in my class and you're listening to this, you have access to a worksheet activity called Research Scenarios at the top that gives you a long series of scenarios for each. You can determine the design, the appropriate tests that should be run, and identify the independent and the dependent variable, or the independent variables if there are several. And that's exactly the process I'm going to guide you through in these slides. So we're starting on slide 3 here. This is my recommended path of decisions for how you're going to decide which test to run. First task, identify several aspects of the design. First, what are the independent variables? How many independent variables are there? And what is the dependent variable? And in the future, when you learn about tests with multiple dependent variables, you'll also need to decide how many of those there are. You don't have to do that for this course. Next question, how many levels are in each independent variable and what are they? Once you know all this, you can think about how those independent variables are manipulated. Are they manipulated between subjects, meaning that different people experience the levels of that independent variable? Or are they manipulated within subjects, meaning that everybody in the group experiences all levels of that independent variable? Then what type of data are you dealing with in each independent variable and each dependent variable? Are you dealing with nominal data, ordinal, ratio, or scale? Biggest question there is, are you dealing with scalar data in your dependent variable? Because if you are, if you're not, you have a pretty easy road from here on in. You know that you're going to conduct one kind of chi-squared test, one or the other. If it's scalar data, then you'll have to think a bit more, depending on how many independent variables you have and how they're manipulated. So know which of these aspects, which answers to these aspects, lead you to each particular stats test. And once you get there, see if you can identify the null and alternative hypotheses for the study design that's being described to you. And so then if you could identify those, then you should know how you could move from those hypotheses through the data you have to get to a p-value that will enable you to write a decision sentence, the kind of results section style sentence that we've been working on for, I'd say, at least the second half of the semester. If you're reading the Adams and Lawrence Research and Stats textbook, I recommend reading chapter 15. It's a good one. And as I say, there is a worksheet that accompanies this idea, this lecture. So let's start off by looking at several different research designs in tree format. The first of these is a case in which you have one sample that you're planning to compare to a population. So if your dependent variable is nominal data, you're probably looking at a chi-square goodness of fit test, right? Because you've got some previous population data that you're going to compare to your current sample. If your dependent variable is ratio or interval data, and maybe even if it's ordinal data, you're going to then need to make a secondary determination. If you know both the mean and the standard deviation of the population, then you can perform a z-test, which was covered, I believe, in your previous course in Research and Stats 1. We didn't talk about that in this course, so there's no chance of it appearing on a final exam for it. But if there is a situation where you know mu and not the standard deviation, not sigma, that is, not the standard deviation of the population, and in that case you would run a one-sample t-test. So big takeaway here, if you have a sample and you're comparing it to a population, if that sample's data are nominal, you're going to run a chi-square goodness of fit net test. If they are anything else, ratio mostly, you're going to run a one-sample t-test. If you're looking at the difference between two samples, so you've got some independent variable that is manipulated now, and it's manipulated with two levels, then you're probably looking for one of these kinds of t-tests. So this particular slide gives you a couple more tests than we've looked through, just sort of for completeness sake. If you've got a manipulation that's within subjects, and that within subjects manipulation leads to ratio or interval data, then you're going to conduct a paired samples t-test. And you really don't have to know any other possibility there. But if you've got between subjects data, and you're looking at the difference between two samples, those data might be nominal. And if that's the case, it would require you to conduct a chi-square test for independence. On the other hand, if the data are ratio or interval, you'll be conducting an independent samples t-test. Mann-Whitney and Wilcoxon tests, again, are offered here for completeness, not part of an exam in my Research Methods and Stats 2 course. Now, if you're looking at a difference between more than two samples, but in one independent variable, we've got the tree of decisions located on slide 6. So we're talking here about instances in which you have one independent variable that has more than two levels to it. So in the end, you're going to test the differences between more than two samples. So if you've got one variable that has three levels or one variable that has 10 levels, both of those and anything in between and anything above 10, of course, all fits into this slide. So if those data are manipulated within subjects and they are ratio data in the dependent variable, then you're going to conduct a one-factor repeated measure ANOVA, or a one-way repeated measure ANOVA. And you might afterward conduct a post hoc test if you have a significant ANOVA. On the other hand, if the experiment was manipulated between subjects, if the data are nominal, you might still be able to conduct a chi-square test for independence. So there are instances in which there is intentional manipulation that results in a chi-square test for independence, and others in which we're just sort of looking for measurements. You can conduct a chi-square test for independence on a 2x2 framework, which would look a lot like a t-test, or you can conduct it on any larger table. So we've done some of those kinds of math as well. But if you've got ratio or interval data here in which there is one independent variable manipulated between subjects with more than three levels to it, you're going to conduct a one-factor independent samples ANOVA, or a one-factor between subjects ANOVA, independent groups. We've called it many different things. Any of those are fine. And if it's significant, you're going to run the appropriate post hoc test. Now here again, there are a couple others. The Kruskal-Wallis and the Friedman tests for ordinal data are here for completeness, not something that will appear on your exam. If you're looking for differences between more than two samples and those samples come from two or more independent variables, we have three different possible situations. If all those independent variables are manipulated between subjects, you have ratio or interval data, then you're going to run what's called here a multi-factor independent samples ANOVA. We've previously called it a two-way between subjects or independent groups ANOVA. And if appropriate, you might follow that up with post hoc tests. Remember that if that's a 2x2 ANOVA, it might be difficult to achieve those post hoc tests, particularly in SPSS. You could theoretically do them by hand. If you've got two or more independent variables manipulated all within subjects, then you're going to run, and you still have ratio or interval data, then you're going to run a multi-factor or a two-way repeated measures ANOVA. And if appropriate, run appropriate post hocs. if you've got some manipulated between subjects and some manipulated within and ratio or interval data, then you will conduct a mixed ANOVA. So we've called that factorial in our course. And as we've said a couple of times, you'll see factorial used a bit more loosely than that in most sort of published psychology situations. We'll go ahead and stick to that language here just for the sake of clarity. So these two multi-factor independent and repeated measures ANOVAs are the ones we'll call two-way. And this last kind, this mixed factor ANOVA on the slide, is what we'll call a factorial ANOVA. And of course, you might run post-hoc tests on such a thing as well. Now, we haven't talked too much about the correlation relationship between two variables, something you also covered in the previous course, so not something likely to pop up on our final exam. But if you've got ratio interval data there, that's probably the version of this you're most familiar with, in which you'll run an analysis that'll deliver you a Pearson correlation coefficient. You may not know that you also can look for correlations with ordinal or nominal data. You can actually just run them through the analysis to get to a Pearson correlation coefficient, but that's not as good a measure as these other correlations, these other correlational measurement methods. So if you're curious about these kinds of things in the future, they are again here for your interest, none on this test. Now moving through to slide 9, the other thing that you might think about for the final exam in Research Methods and Stats 2 is how to fill out an equation sheet. If you're taking this course online, there probably isn't an equation sheet to fill out for the final exam, because how would I keep track of whether you did it or not? So if you're taking it in person, this last section will be helpful for you. If you're taking it online, then it might just be something to practice, something to prepare for the final. So slide 10 is an example of something you might see on the final exam. You might get an equation sheet that has all this stuff on it. And when it's all jumbled like this and out of order and has no labels, it might be a little intimidating, and I totally understand that. And so my goal is to describe to you the process by which you can move from one of these equations into the next within the chain of equations that are required to get to a particular statistic. So what I'm going to try to communicate is that using a little logic and a basic level of knowledge about each of the stats you're trying to build, you can figure out your way into what each equation is used for without having to memorize the exact contents of each equation as you move your way, say, from sample data to a t-value. So slide 11 is the three equations you need for independent groups t-tests. And so the handy thing about these is that each outcome appears in the next equation in the sequence. So you can connect the standard error of the difference between the means, SE sub x minus x, to the pooled variance and the pooled standard deviation by realizing that they sit inside of each other's equations. And so you can move yourself, once you've got your pooled standard deviation, you can then you then know what equation you're going to use next. It's the one that uses pooled standard deviation squared. So nice and easy to transition from that into standard error of the difference between the means. And once you have that, you know that you're going to use it. So you're going to head into this equation that is T, the difference in the means divided by the standard error of that difference. So the only thing sort of left unclear here is the pooled standard deviation. That one doesn't have a dead giveaway in it for exactly what it might be, but it is the longest and most complicated of most of the things you're going to see on most exams in stats. It's the it doesn't have any any dead giveaways that it's a repeated measures t-test, as we'll talk about in a second, that all those equations have d's in them because you're looking at differences. All the ANOVA equations have those capital sigmas in them, meaning that you're summing some number, some larger set of numbers. And so here you can just have standard deviation 1 and 2 and N1 and 2 because that's all you have. So you know that that's an equation that applies to a t-test. On slide 12, you see the things you'll need for Cohen's D of an independent group's t-test. Essentially, what you're doing here is you're still calculating pooled standard deviation and then just taking the difference between the means and dividing it by that pooled standard deviation. In order to calculate Cohen's D, you assume that both groups have the same sample size, and so you can actually simplify the equation for pooled standard deviation. And so I probably wouldn't put the simplified pooled standard deviation equation on a test, on an equation sheet. I might, I'm trying to be really tricky, but probably not. It would just be a matter of remembering that if you're going to stop on your way to T and calculate D, you need to know the difference between what happens when you subtract the means and divide by pooled standard deviation, and what happens when you divide instead by the standard error of the difference between the means. In that first case, you get D. In the second case, you get T. For a repeated measures t-test, like I was just saying before, all these have capital D's in them to show that there's difference, that we're talking about the difference between the two levels of the independent variable, right? You might remember that that process includes subtracting and then one trial from the next and then squaring all the values. So that's sort of the giveaway I use here. And we also have the situation where the thing you calculate in one equation is the thing you use in the very next one. So if you can just remember that the sum of all the differences squared minus the sum of the differences, n squared, divided by n minus 1, and the square, taking the square root of, equals the standard deviation of the difference, then you can move yourself in to figuring out all the rest, because you'll know you need to go and then use that S sub D for your S sub D bar when you divide it by the square root of n, and then you'll know that you need S sub D bar to get to T observed when you divide it, when you divide D bar by S sub D bar. And we've got the little equation for D bar on this slide as well. It's just the sum of all the differences divided by the number of differences there are. So again, the presence of difference is probably the giveaway that can lead you to figure out which equation is which for a repeated measures t-test. Backing up just a little bit, rather than talking about t-tests for differences between two groups, I'm going to talk about one sample t for just a bit. So we talked about one sample t-test confidence intervals, and the width of a confidence interval in that situation differs based on whether the population standard deviation is known. And the dead giveaway for the confidence interval width equations is that plus or minus value that comes after x bar, right? You've got to add your value to add your value to the mean and then subtract your value from the mean to get the two edges of your interval. And so that's the giveaway that tells you that you're looking at a confidence interval equation. You'll just need to know the difference between which you use when you know the population standard deviation and what you do when the population standard deviation is unknown, which, if you still remember, that sigma and S delineate the population and the sample respectively, you can get there pretty easily. Staying in the one sample t-test area, here are the equations for power. So we first have the equations to calculate power, and then on the second bottom half of the slide, we have the equations for when you're shooting for a particular level of power and you want to find the necessary sample size. Because we aren't calculating z-tests in this course, the presence of z in these equations is probably the best giveaway I can give you. It's also the only place we've got that X bar sub alpha, the calculated mean or the anticipated mean based on our alpha level. And what else can I say here? 1 minus beta, of course, is only going to appear in one spot. And then when you're calculating n, we've got 2 z scores subtracted from each other, z sub alpha and z sub beta. So you know that those are power because it's the only instance that where you're going to need both of those values. And actually, there's this fun little fact alongside here that if you recognize that denominator as the difference between the means squared divided by the standard deviation squared for a one sample t-test, you can simplify that denominator to effect size. But I probably wouldn't put that second simplified version in a test. You would have the first one, and you could use the second one if you so chose. For a one-way independent group's ANOVA, this is where you start having these big sigmas that signal the sum of groups. And then for degrees of freedom, those little equations would probably not even appear on the equation sheet. That's something that you might need to just go ahead and memorize. Same for mean squares and F values. But the sums of squares equations would appear on an equation sheet. I wouldn't expect you to memorize those. And often I'll also throw on like the fact that SS total minus SS between is an equation, and that'll give you a cue that you should look for the other sums of squares equations. And so it's just a matter of keeping them straight. You're looking at sums of squares between subjects if there is some sub k value, if you're looking at the values within a group. But if you're not, if you're just summing everything, then you're looking at SS total. And then for a one-way repeated measures ANOVA, the only thing you need to get probably additionally comfortable with is how to calculate the degrees of freedom for that interaction term, and that is k minus 1 times the number of participants per group included in each group minus 1. And of course, the bit of memory that for the F value, we're not going to divide by the within subjects term, we're dividing by the interaction term. So once you've got those things straight, you can do most of what you would need, all of what you would need, rather, by hand for a repeated measures ANOVA for this exam. And then the last thing here is the Tukey post-hoc test. This is recognizable because it's the only thing with a mean square in it. The only time you would use a mean square to calculate anything else is for Tukey's post-hocs. And then you can always do a Bonferroni alpha level correction for any test you do. If you run a whole bunch of tests on one data set, all you do is take your alpha level and divide it by that number of tests. This is probably something that wouldn't appear on an exam sheet anyway. So that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening. Good luck in your studying. I recommend creating practice problems for yourself. That is always the best way to study for virtually any course. Do the work to create the questions, try to get a group of people together to swap and share questions, and then try to answer everybody's questions later. Maybe even see if you can answer your own questions again a week after you answered them the first time. These kinds of things are, yes, absolutely challenging, sometimes frustrating, but that is where real learning occurs. If it feels too easy, you're not learning anything. And if it feels too difficult, you're also not learning anything. You need to find that happy medium of slight struggle that is, in the end, solvable. Good luck.